I'm Christopher Lydon with another one of Michael Lewis's few brave forecasters of still another financial catastrophe. Michael Lewis said, it's only the people who sound crazy and apocalyptic who understand the problem. James Kwok is one of them. Co-author with Simon Johnson of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Meltdown. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. This one with James Kwok extends the examination of the bankocracy. James Kwok, these 13 bankers come up twice. At the end of the Clinton administration, Larry Summers told a bureaucrat that he had 13 bankers in his office who said there would be a financial crisis if she even thought of regulating the derivatives in the market. And then 13 bankers show up early in the Obama years on the White House lawn to say that we are the banking system you've got and make do with us.
That's exactly what.
You guys say you've seen this kind of pattern before. It's called oligarchy. It's called state takeover. And it happens all over the world. How can it have happened here?
Essentially, what we're talking about is the capture of political power by an economic elite. And when we say it's happened all over the world, this is no surprise to anyone, and it's certainly no surprise to people at the International Monetary Fund or even the U.S. Treasury Department. Because for a long time, certainly since the 1990s, the standard diagnosis of a financial crisis in a developing country, in an emerging market like the ones we saw in the 1990s in Thailand and Korea and Russia and many places, the standard diagnosis has been this is the result of the misuse of political power. What happens is you have an economic elite which is either friends with the people, either the friends of the people in power, or they buy the people in power, and they use their political power to get economic favors, like cheap loans from state-owned banks, and they use these economic favors to make lots of money, to inflate the economy and create a bubble. And then when it bursts, they go back to their political connections and they ask for help. They ask to be bailed out, and they get special favors from the state-owned banks or from the government. And the people who take the hit are ordinary people, taxpayers, workers who get laid off because the government has to cut back on its social programs. And this is, again, this is something we see all the time around the world. It's something that the U.S. itself has diagnosed. But what's controversial, or why people are upset by what we say, is that in the United States, we don't like to think that we have an oligarchy.
Well, of course not. Oligarchs are for Russians.
Exactly.
The fundamental point, though, is that these crises are about politics more than about economics.
Exactly. And I think that's something that, again, not only is it something Americans don't want to hear because we like to think that we have the world's most advanced economy, world's most advanced democracy, but it's also something that the financial sector is trying to cover up as we speak. So in the past week, a parade of financial dignitaries appeared before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And the common message, it was almost like they had had the same media training beforehand. The common message was that no one could have seen this coming. This was a 100-year flood. This was a natural disaster. And that's the theme that the financial industry is trying to put forward. And what we say in the book is that, no, it wasn't a natural disaster. It was engineered. It was the product of conscious intention by the banking industry. And that's how we got into this problem.
How would you prove that?
Well, I think if you look back at some of the key changes in policy without which we could not have had the crisis, they happened over the last 20 or 30 years. And we're talking about things that people know a lot about and things that are less well known. So, for example, we start early in the book. We talk about Brooksley Bourne, you were mentioning earlier, and her attempt to regulate custom derivatives. Custom derivatives played an important role in the crisis. It certainly would not have been nearly as big as it was without things like custom credit default swaps. And Brooksley Bourne was essentially shouted down by Alan Greenspan, Robert Rubin, and Larry Summers, who represented the economic establishment in Washington. And these three people, I think with the best of intentions, or perhaps the best of intentions, sincerely believed the line that they were hearing from Wall Street, from the bankers on Wall Street, who said that if you need to let us innovate freely in derivatives and in the financial markets, and that will be good for America. And by contrast, if you shut us down, it'll have catastrophic implications for the economy. So that's one example of the kind of pressure that Wall Street brought to bear. There's a much smaller example an important example that fewer people know about. As I think as many people know now, the crisis was centered around mortgage-backed securities, so turning people's mortgages into various complex products that eventually blew up. This was made possible in the mid-1980s when Louis Ranieri from Salomon Brothers, who became famous in Liar's Poker, Michael Lewis's first book, Ranieri was the inventor of mortgage bond trading, essentially at Salomon. But he had a problem, which is that there were various legal restrictions that made the legal status of mortgage-backed securities uncertain. So he went to Congress, and he lobbied for a law that was passed in 1984 to relax these constraints. And his argument was, if you let me do this, we're going to bring more capital into the mortgage market. Mortgage rates will go down, and more people will be able to buy houses. And of course, Congress loved that. They ate it up. They passed the law. And as they say, the rest is history. So there are many different policies which might have been able to stop the crisis or make it much less severe than it was. But those were the paths not taken in the past 20 or 30 years.
A couple of things could shake things up. One, a real apocalypse. But meantime, it seems to me, you're interested in educating people about the way oligarchy works. Explain it to me. What do these guys get for owning the casino?
Yeah.
Explain how it works for them.
Sure. So oligarchy, I believe, I don't know if it was coined by, but it was defined by Aristotle. So it's a political system in which the economic elite, the rich, control the government. And I think in many ways, this is what we have in the U.S. because Wall Street controls at least all the aspects of the government that apply to them, specifically economic policy, financial policy. And the way Wall Street controls the government is interesting. As opposed to Russia, so the modern usage of oligarchs comes from Russia. I don't actually think there's a lot
of... after communism, they basically parceled out the great assets to
their
few
funds.
Good buddies.
Yes, exactly, through rigged auctions. And that is corrupt, and that would be a crime in the United States. I'm not sure if it was a crime in Russia at the time. I don't think... I'm sure there was crime involved in the financial crisis, but I don't think it was necessary. So in the United States, I think the key lever of power is... Well, there are a few levers of power. Everyone understands money is important. The financial sector gives vast amounts of money to politicians and spends vast amounts on lobbying. But I think the more important levers are the revolving door and ideology. So, and these are closely related. So the revolving door is the phenomenon of people going back and forth from Wall Street to Washington to Wall Street. And you have this club where people believe the same things in Wall Street and in Washington. And they finish each other's sentences and they agree on the solutions. But even more important than the revolving door, I think, is ideology. Because the reason that banks don't need to pay off politicians in this country, don't need to pay them off illegally, there's plenty of legal paying off, as we all know, in the political system. The reason they don't need to pay them off illegally is that for a large part, the politicians already believe what they already are buying what the banks are selling. The banks for decades have been selling the idea that free financial markets will be good for America because they help the optimal allocation of capital. This is one of the magic words that they use, the allocation of capital, and because they provide liquidity to markets. And then the argument is essentially, trust us, these things are good, they will make poor people less poor. And that was the mantra that was swallowed by the Democratic Party in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Now, to some extent, we expect the Republicans to believe this instinctively, but what happened in the 1990s is the Democratic Party also adopted a Wall Street-friendly position on finance, and suddenly we had nobody pushing back against Wall Street. We had both parties. We had the consensus in Washington being that big banks are good and finance is good, and you know, big banks are good, and what's good for Wall Street is good for Washington. And this is why we say that in the United States we have the world's most advanced economy. We also have the world's most advanced oligarchy because it's much better to be able to use the power of persuasion, the soft power of ideology, than to have to pass money under the table, which is illegal and might get you thrown in jail. Very few people are going to go to jail as a result of this crisis.
This notion that they have made a selling point of the idea that their policies will make poor people less poor through easy credit is a fascinating one. It comes up in Michael Lewis's book, and I wanted to draw you out on it. The basic notion... The practical application of it, meaning that no, we can't pay you more, but we can give you a very, very cheap loan on a house.
Yes,
we maybe even force money on you with no interest and no payments for a while to give you that credit. Again, if we saw this happening in China, that China is gouging people on wages but giving them astonishingly easy credit on housing. We'd scratch our heads and say, how did that happen? Or who thought that up? Or was it a government idea or just something improvised to because it worked? Explain it. How did that happen in this country?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I think, first of all, the United States does have this long-term cultural or ideological bias towards home ownership.
Right.
It goes back towards the 1930s.
The American dream.
Yes, exactly. The American dream is to own a house in the suburbs. And this is something that And this is part of the United States being a middle-class society. We say we're a middle-class society. What we mean by that is we're not like those bad old European societies, which were, you know, upper class versus working class. You know, politicians in the U.S. rarely talk about the working class. So the goal of kind of mainstream American policy was to create this land-owning middle class as opposed to a land-owning aristocracy. And I think what you said was very interesting, because in the 1990s, precisely when all this energy and this money was going into increasing homeownership, wages were growing slowly. And then in the last 10 years, they've been flat. And what has happened has been exactly as you say, we have substituted homeownership for a decent wage. It's an open question. Did this happen because millions of people wanted houses and were banging on the doors of their banks and saying, please come up with a new product that will enable me to buy a house?
Right.
Or did it happen because Wall Street had a product they wanted to sell and they found the buyers?
That's a key question. There was an effort there when the bubble burst to blame the people who weren't really qualified for home ownership for wanting it.
Exactly.
And getting in, you know, out too deep. But did they choose it, or were they, the way you write it, they were inveigled into it with an irresistibly cheap housing loan by the banks who were making serious money on it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that many of the people who are now facing foreclosure were inveigled into it by the banks. I mean, I think it was Michael Lewis who has the story of a immigrant farm worker making $14,000 who gets a $700,000 mortgage.
Exactly.
I kind of doubt that this person woke up one morning thinking, I'm going to buy a $750,000 house. It's a little bit absurd. I mean, I think there probably were, almost certainly were, a small number of people who very calculatingly said, you know, a no money down, no doc, optional interest mortgage is a great way to speculate on housing prices. Because I can put no money down. If it goes up, I make money. If it goes down, I just mail in the keys. I'm sure there were, you know, thousands of people just doing that. But at the same time, we have millions of people facing foreclosures. And to blame it on them, I think, is an egregious display of arrogance.
In general, James Clark, it seems to me the case is sort of clear, even to amateurs like me, that this was a rigged game and it collapsed. And at the same time, the fascinating question is why the political system hasn't responded, especially because there has been a tradition in this country of, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, of all people, attacking malefactors of great wealth, Franklin Roosevelt being proud of his enemies on Wall Street and holding them out there for everybody to see, and yet a kind of silence in the media and in mainstream politics about doing anything. What can you imagine, and would it have to be just terrible bad news, that would break the silence here, the polite silence around these men we can't seem to live without?
Yeah, well, first we have to think a little bit about why has so little happened. And the conventional explanation has been that, oh, it's just good luck in Congress, right? It's the Republicans' fault, it's the filibuster in the Senate, et cetera. And I think that has a grain of truth. But I think it's missing the deeper point. And the deeper point is that there's essentially a cover-up. And the cover-up is this, and it's a cover-up that I think some of the media is complicit in. It's this idea that, well, what hurt us this time were subprime mortgages and mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations and securitization, and we're going to fix that, right? So we're going to put in some new rules that make it harder to screw poor people with mortgages. We're going to put in some new rules that say that banks, if they securitize mortgages, they have to hold on to some of the assets they're creating and so on. And that is, you know, this is what they call bolting the barn door after the horse leaves. Because what we talk about in the book is we say that, yes, it was this set of products that caused the crisis this time. But the underlying cause was the situation where a particular industry controls the policies relevant to it in Washington and is therefore able to create an environment where it can take lots of risk, make lots of money, and shift the downside to the taxpayers. And that you know, as you've noted, that has not changed, and that is unlikely to change in the current session of Congress. So when you ask what could wake people up, I mean, there's a range of scenarios. After we had a panic in 1907, it led to the creation of the Federal Reserve. It led to the creation of a relatively faulty Federal Reserve. And then 16 years after the Federal Reserve was created, we had the crash of 1929, we had the Great Depression, and then we had the great banking regulations of 1933 and 1934. So yes, one possibility is a true economic calamity, significantly greater than what we just saw. Hopefully it won't come to that. I don't think that is necessarily certain. I think if we had a downturn in the economy, which is certainly a possibility, I think some of these large banks still might end up going bankrupt. Some of the weaker banks have gotten a little bit stronger, but they still have these toxic assets we've heard about for more than a year and a half. They're still sitting on the balance sheets of these banks waiting to explode. And we could have another crisis where a bank needs government funding. And at that point, I'm not sure that that anyone in Washington has the political capital to bail out another large bank. And that might be a trigger for change.
What about a cultural awakening? You guys had the nerve to use as an epigraph to your book a wonderful line from The Great Gatsby, in which Nick Carraway says about Tom Buchanan and his wife Daisy, "They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess they had made." What would it take for people to believe once again that those bankers are just rich bastards out on Long Island who couldn't care less?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people actually believe that right now. This is in a sense, I don't want to say silver lining. This is one of the small positive things that has come out of this crisis. As I said, a year ago, there was a huge wave of popular anger centered on the AIG bonuses, but really directed at all of Wall Street and at the system that brought us this crisis. I think that anger has – two things have happened. On the one hand, it's faded a little bit because it's no longer in the center of the news. But at the other hand, it's getting – what's left of it is in a sense, is becoming more angry. Because as time passes and people see that nothing has changed and people see that the politicians and the media are often saying that the economy is recovering, but people know that unemployment is still 9.7%. And this is twice the level of unemployment we had 10 years ago. So one thing you mentioned earlier was that people, in a sense, don't know what to do with this anger. Some of it is going to the Tea Party and Sarah Palin, which I think is not good for American democracy. And one thing that Simon and I wanted to do with this book is explain to people, yes, you should be angry, and this is why, and to talk about what the potential solution might be. And we go back to Teddy Roosevelt, as you noted. We talk about him early in the historical section. We go back to him at the end as an example of someone who, not only through his political power, but also through his I don't want to say intellectual leadership, but his leadership. Through his leadership, he was able to effect a change in what people thought about large companies and the relationship of economic power and political power. So I do think that, in the long term, the policies in Washington follow the will of the people. They follow it imperfectly and slowly. But if the conventional wisdom shifts away from this ideology of finance and towards a much more skeptical view of finance, I think in the long term, it's possible that Washington will change. In the short term, the people we have in Washington were elected and brought up and inculcated in this ideology over the last 15 years, and I don't actually expect a lot from them.
At some level, it becomes personal. Teddy Roosevelt did stare down J.P. Morgan. Can you imagine Barack Obama staring down Jamie Dimon? What would it sound like? Imagine them.
Well, so
whose club would it be at, first of all, and then how does the conversation go?
It's an interesting question. Obviously, I don't know either man personally. The impression I have of Barack Obama, which of course is from the media and is constructed by many many people between me and him, that impression does not give me confidence that he would stare down Jamie Dimon in a staring match. And I say that because many of the attributes that we value in Barack Obama are his thoughtfulness, his desire to listen to the smartest people, to bring people together and make his decision, but based on input and thinking through the arguments of a lot of people. And I think that Barack Obama also, I would say, in a sense, doesn't have the stomach for this fight. And I say that because it's not a fight he wanted. Right? The financial sector was not anywhere on his to-do list during the Democratic primary. I suspect he did not have particularly strong opinions either way about it. When he won the election, he had to choose an economic team. And he chose the obvious people in the sense that he chose the people who were the economic policy heavyweights of the Clinton administration. And this is not sinister. This is simply going back to the last Democratic administration and picking the people that President Clinton had. And I think this is one weakness is that the Democratic Party had no internal opposition. When it came to economic policy, most people in the Democratic Party thought, isn't it wonderful that we've gotten away from the union organizers and the lefties? And isn't it wonderful that we have a coherent policy that's trusted by Wall Street, that's friendly to the business community, that we don't have to be embarrassed about and will enable us to raise tremendous amounts of money from the financial sector? Remember, the Democrats today are the party of fiscal discipline and economic management, especially compared to George W. Bush. This is a huge political boon to the party. And I think the price that we pay for that is it meant that they, as I said earlier, they subscribed to the Wall Street line on these positions. So when Obama, when he won the election, he chose his team from the center of the Democratic policy establishment. And these are people who, in the Summers and Geithner cases, were in part architects of the financial system we have today. And that is where Obama is getting his advice from. So I don't think, on the one hand, I don't think he necessarily believes that we need fundamental change. And again, it's not something I think he wants to use political capital on when you think about the priorities he has. I think President Obama had a choice. He had a choice about a little over a year ago, and we opened the book with this meeting with 13 banking CEOs at the end of March 2009. When President Obama famously said, my administration is the only thing between you and the pitchforks. So President Obama was aware that there was a angry popular movement against Wall Street. And at that meeting, he essentially said, I'm inferring from the results, but he essentially said, I will protect you, but please be nice. Please don't pay yourself as much money. Please stop saying outrageous things on TV, and please change your ways so that I don't have to do anything stronger. And I think Politico said people nodded their heads, but they made no firm commitments.
Take a crack at the question that Simon Johnson didn't want to answer the other night. Robert Rubin was the guy who came into the Clinton administration and deregulated the economy. After that, he put his friend Larry Summers in as Treasury when he left, and then he put Larry Summers in as president of Harvard when the Clinton administration was over. The Harvard faculty took its look at Larry Summers and said, thanks but no thanks, and in 5 years he was out. Why is the Beltway establishment so much slower to make a tough judgment? Is the Harvard faculty now the example of kind of tough-minded managers who will say, no, it's not working. Try again.
Yeah. Not tough-minded managers. I think that the Harvard faculty have one big advantage over Congress. I think it's fair to say the Harvard faculty are captured by nobody. They have essentially lifetime tenure. They are people who are accustomed to thinking that they are the smartest person in the room. They often are the smartest person in the room in their area of expertise. They have a habit of projecting that into all areas of expertise. And if they don't like Larry Summers, they're going to tell Larry Summers what they think of him, and they're going to do everything they can to get rid of him. If you think about Congress and Washington, it has two major differences. And one is that, on the one hand, people in Congress, especially when it comes to financial matters, they think the guys on Wall Street are smarter than they are. Which may be true, by the way, but they go into the meeting thinking, this guy from Wall Street, look, he makes a lot more money than I do. He's got a better suit than I do. He uses words I don't even understand. He must be smarter than I am. So that's one thing that Congress, one problem they have that Harvard professors don't have. And the other thing is the money, is the capture. I think that most people in Washington, certainly not all of them, or most elected officials, are always thinking about the next election. And I'm not saying they do everything because of the next election, but it's always in their minds. Harvard professors, as I said, have lifetime tenure and for the most part don't care what Larry Summers thinks about them.
But the other big difference, James, I think, is that the Harvard faculty thinks of itself, all those egomaniacs and wise people, but they're jealous rivals and whatnot, but they think of themselves as the repository, the real university, the community of scholars that endures. It's not the football team. It's not the fundraising department. It's not buildings and grounds. It's not the CEO corporate university. It's us scholars. And what we're missing in Washington, it seems to me, is the people who think, hey, we must have the permanent long-term interests of the republic in our soul, and we've got to fight for it every once in a while when people like this band from Wall Street try to hijack it.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's very true, and I think that that was something that I think politicians were able to overlook for a long time, because in the 1990s and in the past decade, it was possible to think, I am a caretaker of the long-term interests of the republic, and I want to, for example, repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, because I think that is actually good for the economy in the long term. It's good for prosperity and so on. I think that the financial crisis has made this a tough question for a lot of people, because now it's quite clear that the type of financial system we had that a lot of these same people made possible is deeply flawed and is not good for the republic. And it means that people have to make a choice. And I think that right now, a lot of politicians are doing their best to try to avoid making that choice. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get a financial reform bill, which I would categorize as weak, but probably better than nothing, in which a lot of politicians will be trying to be in favor of some things, which will help solve the consciences, like the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, and at the same time will be voting for relatively large loopholes in the regulations, which will enable a lot of custom derivatives trading to go on just the way it has. So
where will the legislation that passes fall between the regulate the banks impulse, the Paul Krugman idea, and break up the banks, which you and Simon Johnson are pushing hard?
It's going to fall almost entirely on the regulate the banks side of the spectrum, which, again, I think is, although Simon and I think that is insufficient, I think it is, I would certainly say it's better than nothing. So people talk about increasing capital requirements, that's a good thing. The more capital a bank has, less likely it is to fail, the less profitable it is as well. I think you know a lot of the skepticism that Simon and I have about that line of policy, which is, I mean, to put it simply, anytime you write a rule, the bank's lawyers will find a way around it. That should be a lesson from the last 20 years that I think people are overlooking. And anytime you have a rule and you give a regulator discretion in how to apply that rule, they will generally apply it in a way that's favorable to the industry. Another lesson that I think people have not learned from the last 20 years. So this is why we think that the idea of simply smarter, better regulation is simply not enough. But I put it in the category of somewhat better than nothing.
Who could you imagine as a sort of Ted Kennedy-esque figure of serious stature, whether he wins a majority or not, but who would just bang on his desk to get serious attention to your claim that oligarchs have taken over the Democratic Republic of the United States?
The first person who comes to mind is Paul Volcker, and I say that because I think Volcker has an uncomfortable situation. So he was somewhat marginalized by the administration.
Right.
He was making his frustrations more and more apparent in the press last fall. That said, Volcker is a member of the administration, and he's going to get compromised away during the current session. It's hard to see where a challenge is going to come from. I mean, I could certainly see somebody on the far right side of the spectrum banging the table.
Yeah,
I think that's
too.
Actually where it's more likely to come from, because the Democratic Party, I mean, frankly, we're so happy we have a president in power that no one is going to seriously challenge him. I mean, you know, after George W. Bush, everyone is just so relieved to have a Democrat in power, whether we should be or not, that there isn't going to be a serious challenge. I could very well see a right-wing free market person banging on the table. Ron Paul could take up this issue. I mean, Ron Paul, I think, is dead wrong on many issues and is right on a few issues.
Yeah.
I could really see him taking this up. I don't think Ron Paul is electable, but he could bring it into the mainstream. I briefly thought the other night that maybe Michael Bloomberg And I say that because Michael Bloomberg has what we used to call in the technology industry "fuck you" money, right? On the other hand, Michael
Knows the bond market and the no holds barred kind of tactics that it requires.
Exactly. I would say Michael Bloomberg is a very long shot, and I say that for two reasons. One is I don't know the man; I don't know what he actually believes, but he is a creature of Wall Street. He may side with the Wall Street banks. Secondly, they are his big customers of the company. He's still. I actually don't know if he still owns it or they put it in a blind trust or what. But there's some chance he has the money and he has the credibility, somebody like that. But again, Michael Bloomberg himself, I couldn't predict what he's going to do. But it seems like it might have to be an independent or conservative at this point.
A newspaper? Huffington Post?
I was about to ask if we had newspapers anymore. But the Huffington Post, certainly Arianna Huffington has been very outspoken. I think that, you know, the evolution of the media is a fascinating topic that I'm sure we don't have time for. I don't know to what extent Huffington has the ability to rally her millions of readers behind a specific cause. She has put a lot of effort behind the Move Your Money campaign, asking people to withdraw money from big banks, put it into small banks. I'm a big fan of that. I've had several posts on my blog about how I strongly dislike Bank of America and how happy I was to take my money out of Bank of America. But we may need to look outside of the typical class of political leaders.
It might be you and Michael Lewis. I'd love to hear your thought on the media thing. I mean, if this were the heyday of newspapers, Colonel McCormick or Joseph Pulitzer would decide this is the way to sell papers, is to rally the people against the banks to save the economy. Mm-hmm. What if we've dealt ourselves, James, into a media vacuum right at the moment when we need a strong New York Times to say, Wall Street is in grave jeopardy, we've got to reform it to save it? Or we've got to have Walter Cronkite there to say, Mr. President, from Vietnam here, I can see that this war was a mistake. And in any event, it's over. I mean, is there anybody on this landscape with the credibility to take your position?
So I tend to be a skeptical, pessimistic person. So I think it's entirely possible that that has happened, in part because we talk about the ideological fragmentation of the media. So the internet has allowed this great flowering of ideas, mm-hmm. but it's also made it almost instinctively, people tend to marginalize strong political ideas and say that's the ideology, that's some splinter group. So at the same time, it's gotten much easier for people to express ideas and to get a following of hundreds of thousands of people or even a couple million people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they implicitly ghettoize themselves. So the first name that came to my mind was Jon Stewart. To tell you the truth.
Good point.
Jon Stewart has moments of seriousness.
When he tears apart James Cramer, for example.
Yes, and certainly during the Iraq War, there was a period when his fake news show was, you know, the place where you could get the most realistic commentary on the Iraq War. I'm not sure this is going to be Jon Stewart's issue, but again, he's the first name that came to mind.
That's a good idea. We come back to Michael Lewis's line that, you know, the people who sound most unhinged are the only hinged ones there. This is a dangerous moment.
It is. I think that there's a, you know, we have, this is a device that I think Wall Street has used over the past 20 years, which is essentially to say that anyone who criticizes them, like Brooksley Born in 1998, people who criticize them simply don't understand. And they've been able to get away with this because Wall Street has gotten much more complicated. It's much more mathematical. There are many models involved. We know that there's a distinct culture. There's a distinct way of doing business, which outsiders, for the most part, do not get. And right now, they consider Michael Lewis an outsider because he was a trader, a salesman in the 1980s and not today. We are at a moment right now when people should be saying, that was all a fraud. So that was all complication, which did not work. The mathematics was wrong. The models were flawed, and it was not only bad for society. Many of these banks blew themselves up in the process. So we should no longer accept the brush off that says, no, you just don't understand how things are done. It's something that Michael Lewis talks about in his book. Mm. You have to be willing to ask people questions. If you don't understand something, you have to be willing to ask them to explain it and explain it and explain it. And if you don't think it makes sense, it probably doesn't make sense. So you brought up an interesting topic with Michael Lewis on your in your interview with him, which was one of the parallels between the financial crisis and the Iraq War is that despite all the things that have gone wrong, we still have largely the same people. We see the same people on TV, the same people in Congress telling us how we should understand the crisis and what we should do next. And you know, during the Bush administration, people were saying, why didn't anyone get fired for the Iraq War? And the same question applies now. Why hasn't anyone been fired because of the financial crisis? I think there's another parallel as well, which is that, the cover-up that's going on by Wall Street today is this idea that the financial crisis was an accident, that it was a lot of people making mistakes. It was lenders making bad lending decisions and home buyers making bad borrowing decisions and rating agencies making bad decisions when they rated these toxic securities, and unbelievably, these investment banks holding on to their own toxic assets and then regulators being asleep at the switch.
Perfect storm.
Yes, exactly. It's the perfect storm theory. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to analogize the financial crisis to a natural disaster. How do you blame someone for a natural disaster? And you hear the same language from the administration. You hear Timothy Geithner saying, well, do we want to protect against a 100-year flood or a 30-year flood? And I think this is deeply wrong, and it's an exact parallel to the Iraq War, because, you know, as we all remember, we invaded Iraq, we didn't find weapons of mass destruction, and what did people say? They said, oh, it was bad intelligence. So people gathering the intelligence made mistakes, people analyzing the intelligence made mistakes, people brought the intelligence to President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and they made an error of judgment because of the bad intelligence, and then a majority of the Congress went and voted for this war because they had been misled. It's the same idea. It's the same idea that it was all an accident. It's not our fault. It's somebody else's fault, and it was just a big mistake. And in both cases, that's just fundamentally wrong. I mean, we invaded Iraq because our political leaders wanted to invade Iraq, and our Congress voted for it because they did not want to be seen as voting against a war in the run-up to an election. And that's all there is to it. And with the financial crisis, I'm not saying that bankers wanted the financial crisis, but they engineered it. They engineered a climate of deregulation and non-regulation that allowed them to invent whatever products they wanted to, sell them to anyone they wanted to, increase their leverage so that they could make larger and larger profits. And they engineered that consciously. This was the product of intention, and it was bound to blow up, and it finally blew up. And that is the message that Wall Street does not want people to hear. They want you to think that it was all a colossal mistake made by well-meaning people who had mistakes in their models. And that is not what happened.
James Kwok, the next financial meltdown is in your subtitle. How sure are you that it's coming?
I am fairly certain it's coming. As someone said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And what I mean by that is this. The current crisis that we've just suffered through and that many people are still suffering through was the product of the political power of Wall Street. And not only are we not doing anything about that in our political system today, but we're not even acknowledging that as the problem. So when people talk about the financial crisis, the mainstream narrative is it was caused by subprime mortgages and it was caused by collateralized debt obligations. And if we can regulate those things, we'll be safe. When the underlying condition that we're repeating over and over again is having a financial system that's allowed to write its own rules and is allowed to create new markets, new markets, when they are created, are almost by definition unregulated because they did not exist before. And if the regulators do not keep up with financial innovation, we're going to have crises like we just saw. There are many possibilities for what markets could explode next. So first of all, as we talked about earlier, it's possible that we could have a downturn in the U.S. economy, which could cause problems, for example, in the commercial real estate market to
people have been waiting for that one for
exactly,
a long time.
To start blowing up on bank balance sheets. So it's possible we could see it essentially as a double dip recession, but there are other possibilities. When you look at places like China, for example, China has some hallmarks of a bubble. China got out of its crisis in the last year and a half, largely by commanding state-owned banks to lend money cheaply to businesses to help get out of the recession. The other hallmark of a bubble that China has is all the stories you hear about how China is going to be the next dominant power and how everything's going right and they can't do anything wrong. That's classic bubble talk. Another possibility people have floated, and you know, this is not a prediction but a possibility, is is carbon emissions. So this is something that people have said. You know, right now we have this political issue in Congress. Last year, the House passed Waxman-Markey, which is a cap and trade bill, which allows banks to make a market in not only in carbon credits but also in derivatives on carbon credits. There's a competing bill in the Senate, sponsored by Maria Cantwell, which essentially does not allow trading. The allocations, it's called cap and dividend. The allocations are given out every year. So if you become more efficient, you don't have to buy as many the next year. But there's no trading between parties. Wall Street wants the cap and trade version because they want to make a market in carbon credits. So I think until we solve the problem of political power of Wall Street, we're going to have these crises because over the last 30 years, empirically speaking, the financial system has gotten more unstable, not less. We have crises in different parts of the world every 5 to 7 years now. We had the SNL crisis. We had the Latin American debt crisis. We had the LTCM crisis of 1998. We had the stock market bubble, and now we had what's generally called the subprime mortgage crisis, and there we're only talking about the crises that affected the United States. So I am not enough of a soothsayer to tell you what products are going to cause the next crisis, but there is going to be one.
James Kwok, thank you for your book, for your work, and for this conversation. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a great pleasure here.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.